Attention listeners, join us at the Shine Music Fest on Saturday, August 24th. Look forward to lots of fun and interactive experiences, including a live recording of the Blind Chick podcast. Learn more and RSVP at www.shinemusicfest.com/event-info.
You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the December 20th, 2021 Monday reading of the Denver Post. My name is Dee Hyslop. Today we will be reading the following main articles. Provider Failing 10 Counties, written by Susan Green of the Colorado News Collaborative. Senator Won't Back Plan, written by Emily Cochran and Katie Edmondson of the New York Times. Omicron May Sideline Two Key Drugs, written by Matthew Perrone of the Associated Press, and following up with miscellaneous articles. Provider failing 10 counties, many say Mind Springs isn't lending adequate services for communities, by Susan Green of the Colorado News Collaborative. In a state where the mental health safety net is plagued by a lack of financial transparency, competition, and the inability or unwillingness to serve the neediest patients, local leaders say one mental health center and its top executives stand out as worse than the rest. Quote, expletive mind springs for one thing, says Sheriff Jamie Fitzsimmons when asked about the threats to mental health in Summit County, and that expletive snake oil saleswoman who runs it for another. Mind Springs Health, led by CEO Sharon Reggio, is the private nonprofit responsible for providing behavioral health safety net services in Summit and nine other western slope counties: Eagle, Garfield, Grand, Jackson, Mesa, Moffitt, Pitkin, Rio Blanco, and Rout. It is one of 17 regional community mental health centers statewide that long have been responsible for inpatient hospitalization, intensive outpatient treatment, outpatient psychiatric care, counseling, and other forms of treatment for Coloradans on Medicaid or who are indigent, underinsured, or in a crisis. A recent Colorado News Collaborative investigation found that many of those mental health treatment centers fail to serve the most vulnerable Coloradans, aided by a system that creates a financial incentive to take on fewer ill people and charge higher costs while also protecting them from competition. Communities served by Mind Springs are among the most frustrated. Nowhere is that disappointment expressed so bitterly and publicly than in Summit County. In 2018, voters passed a tax measure to fund mental health care, even though it meant they are essentially having to pay twice for similar services. Since then, local officials have worked with the state to end three of Mind Springs' contracts, and now they are going a step further by severing ties altogether and joining nearby Eagle County's new community mental health center because leaders in both say the state cannot or will not fix problems with Mind Springs. The split marks the first of its kind in the 50-year history of Colorado's mental health safety system and is prompting other Mind Springs communities to eye ways to take control of their own care. Reggio, in a series of interviews over several months, has not addressed specific reasons for public discontent, telling the Colorado News Collaborative, "I don't believe in litigating issues in the media. It makes me sad that anybody would feel that they got less than adequate services from our organization," she says. "It makes me sad that people have such negative things to say." The new mom, Travis Bickford, doesn't want to hear it. Raggio's words will not bring back what he says Mind Springs, from its clinics to its hospital to its services in the county jail, took from his family. His wife, Jackie Bickford, 31, had a history of depression and alcohol addiction when she sought treatment at the Mind Springs office near their home in Breckenridge in 2016. She was experiencing severe postpartum depression after the birth of their son, Trent, a few months earlier. The clinic prescribed medication that her husband says seemed to make her more depressed and turn her into a zombie. The doctors there just handed that out like it was candy. They would chastise her for overusing the medicine, but then keep refilling her prescription. Because she was talking about ending her life, he and his father-in-law had her committed to the Mind Springs-owned West Springs Psychiatric Hospital in Grand Junction. He says his wife returned home after about 10 days, far worse than when she went in. Constant crying, depression, abusing medicine, drinking vodka. He was at work one day in April 2016 when a nurse called their home for a wellness check. Police responding to the nurse's concern found Bickford drunk and semi-conscious with her infant son nearby and arrested her on suspicion of child abuse and neglect. Her family made the tough decision not to bail her out, assuming she and Trent would be safer if she were in jail where Mind Springs had a contract to provide mental health services. She threatened to kill herself if he was removed from her care, so the jail clothed her in a smock that kept her from hurting herself and put her on a 24/7 suicide watch. Within a day, Bickford persuaded a Mind Springs clinician to clear her to move off suicide watch and into a regular cell among the jail's general population. 4 days later, she killed herself. Her family unsuccessfully sued the sheriff's department, one of its officers, and the Mind Springs clinician who had evaluated her. During a deposition, the family's lawyer asked the clinician whether, in retrospect, she wished she had not cleared Bickford to be taken off of suicide watch. "No," she answered. "Why is that?" the lawyer asked. "Because I did what was presented to me during her evaluation. She was not suicidal at the time," she said. The clinician called Bickford's suicide an impulsive decision, even though records show she had been suicidal for weeks and even the day leading up to it. She also said Bickford's husband told her his wife had improved in the hospital and was not suicidal. Travis Bickford winces when reading the testimony. "It's hard enough that I lost my wife, that Trent lost his mom because we were desperate to get Jackie help and these people didn't do their jobs," he says. "But to sit here knowing this woman blatantly lied to justify her wrongdoing, to have no recourse after we made it perfectly clear Jackie was suicidal and tried like hell to make them help her, well, that takes crazy to a whole new level." The clinician, through a Mind Springs spokesman, declined to comment or provide any written notes of the conversation with Travis Bickford. Trent Bickford, now six and with no recollection of his mother, walks into the room and sees his father crying during an interview. He climbs on the kitchen counter and grabs a paper towel to wipe away the tears. "It's okay," he tells his dad. "I know. Please don't call Mind Springs." Fitzsimmons became sheriff shortly after Bickford's death and inherited the legal aftermath and county residents' deep distrust of their community mental health center. When we'd come across people experiencing crises, they'd have half the time say, "Oh my God, please don't call Mind Springs. I won't talk to them. They're horrible," says Fitzsimmons, whose jail, like many others, is full of people with untreated behavioral health conditions. He and other Summit County officials grew especially impatient with Mind Springs' Mobile Crisis Response Unit. The state-founded program is supposed to dispatch a mental health specialist at any hour to help stabilize people so they don't end up in more expensive emergency rooms. Assistant County Manager Sarah Vane inquired about the program when noticing the number of ER visits wasn't dropping, only to be told by a Mind Springs supervisor in Summit County that the organization was urging clients to go to the ER because it didn't want to risk the safety of its mobile response team members. Mind Springs spokeswoman in response wrote, "There is a delicate balance between a crisis worker's personal safety and responding appropriately to a crisis in someone's home." Officials and private mental health care providers in five other counties with Mind Springs service area also describe their local mobile crisis response units as unresponsive. Raul de Villegas-Decker, a clinical psychologist in Grand Junction, where Mind Springs is headquartered, says the unit there would call the primary care practice where he worked, asking what it could do for someone in crisis. "It was almost laughable. Not the call you would expect from the very people who are paid to know how to handle crises," he says. Even Mind Springs' own staff members say they have problems getting the units to show up. "There's typically nothing mobile at all about our mobile crisis team. It's just basically a call center, and when you call, they act almost like you're inconveniencing them," says a Mind Springs clinician who asked not to be identified for fear of being fired. "Here you have someone who is literally at the lowest point of their life, and they're reaching out or having someone else reaching out for them, and what are we offering them? Nothing, which is terrifying." Raggio says her organization responds appropriately to crises as needed, but declined to discuss any particular incident raised in this story. Raggio, who made $312,331 in 2019, cites a lack of state and federal funding and a maze of red tape as challenges for Mine Springs. But more often than not, the former licensed professional counselor keeps returning to her own history, leading Mine Springs from the verge of bankruptcy with 3 days cash on hand in 2008 to build a psychiatric hospital in 2018 and Women's Recovery Center in 2020. In almost all her interviews, she mentions the multiple business innovation awards the organization has won from industry groups. "We've done a lot of good things," she added. "I know there are naysayers, and that makes me sad. I think we all want the same things and can achieve more working together." A black hole. Mine Springs critics, county officials, former clients, even its own employees say that it's not just mobile crisis units that seem to be MIA. How much tax money the center receives for its programs, what it spends in each county, how many people it employs in each are questions the center can't or won't answer. Mine Springs is a black hole, says Summit County Commissioner Tamara Pogue. "We don't know where the money goes or how it is being spent," adds Beth Melton, a Rout County Commissioner. "It seems to me that we should have an understanding of what services are being provided in the community." Mesa County Commissioner Janet Rowland, who has a background in mental health care, also has questions about how Mine Springs is using state and federal tax dollars. She says Reggio keeps giving different explanations for barriers to care. "I've heard money's an issue. I've at other times heard capacity or staff or state rules and regulations are the issue. We haven't gotten to a real answer about what's getting in the way." Raggio, who refers to herself as an open book, repeatedly has said her organization does not keep its electronic records in a way it could figure out how much it spends per county. "That's a lie," Vane, Summit's assistant county manager, says. In response to CoLab's initial investigation published earlier this month, Mine Springs spokeswoman contradicted Raggio, saying her colleagues do, in fact, keep records by county and would make them available for review. As of this writing, she has not provided them. Alex Wolf, a 22-year-old Summit County resident, has spent years cycling in and out of treatment for borderline personality disorder. In 2018, he did a stint in Mine Springs Psychiatric Hospital, from which he and his mother say he was released on the condition that he attend a certain kind of therapy group offered only at 5:30 p.m. each Wednesday. "I went in at that time. They said, 'Come back next Wednesday.' I went in again. They said, 'There's no such group,'" he says. Trust in Mine Springs' home county of Mesa also is low. In two Mesa County surveys, one to residents and one to health care providers, respondents warned people to stay away from the center. One provider wrote, "The saying is, you might as well commit suicide than go to Mine Springs because they will drive you to it." The Colorado News Collaborative interviewed more than 100 people about Mine Springs. The only praise came from someone who works in its hospital and from three self-identified clients who appeared in one of the organization's marketing videos. CoLab could not locate any of the clients who provided those positive testimonials. In Building Hope, prominent Summit County businesswoman Patty Casey took her life by suicide in January 2016. By that year's end, so had 12 other county residents, a pattern that prompted Casey's family to launch a mental health care nonprofit in her memory. Building Hope quickly drew widespread support for its mission of reducing mental health stigma, increasing access to treatment for Spanish and English speakers, and addressing other local behavioral health challenges. Community members rallied around that mission and proposed a mill levy to pay for mental health services Mine Springs wasn't providing. In less than 3 years, Building Hope has used about $2 million in revenues to help more than 1,800 county residents who either don't have insurance or have a deductible they can't afford to pay for up to 12 therapy sessions. People who have been harmed so badly by the system just needed to have their health honored the way we do for other people who are sick, says Jennifer McCatney, Building Hope's executive director. Vane, Summit's assistant county manager last year kicked MindSpring's detox program out of a county-owned building, then ended MindSpring's contract for that service and worked to prod the state to fund a different nonprofit to run it. Likewise, Fitzsimmons has ended MindSpring's jail and mobile crisis response contracts and replaced them with programs of his choosing. At first, we didn't know we could say no to MindSpring's, Fitzsimmons says, but now I've got sheriffs all over the state calling to learn how to break from community mental health centers that aren't getting the job done. Following Summit's lead, Eagle County in 2018 passed its own mental health tax on marijuana sales. Responding to what County Manager Jeff Schroll says are the same problems other counties have experienced with MindSpring's, his county then went a step further by forming its own community mental health center called Eagle Valley Behavioral Health. The new nonprofit is a subsidiary of Vail Hospital, which will likely build a psychiatric hospital as well as a shorter-term overnight facility to stabilize people in crisis. It will include a team of clinicians co-responding to crisis with law enforcement, a detox program, and all the other safety net services expected by the state. Leaders in Summit County are now working with those in Eagle County and with state behavioral health administrators to fully split from MindSpring's and join the new center. The creation of the state's 18th Community Mental Health Center, the first new one in several decades, challenges the status quo of Colorado's mental health safety net system. The new center will not be joining the Colorado Behavioral Health Care Council, the powerful trade group that represents all other centers throughout the state in contract negotiations and has lobbied against proposals requiring competitive bidding for mental health contracts and more transparency and accountability among the centers. Its creation also will take tens of millions of state and federal tax dollars annually out of MindSpring's pocket. Meanwhile, other counties are also taking action. Mesa County has been researching ways to possibly end some of MindSpring's contracts there. Rout County has been changing some of its contracts with MindSpring's after a flat fee to an hourly rate. So, as Melton tells it, we actually pay for services that they've actually provided. In 6 months of interviews, no one, except for Sheriff Fitzsimmons, called to dismantle Colorado's community mental health centers. But as the state prepares to launch a new cabinet-level department overseeing mental health care this summer, Melton and officials from counties across the state have been asking for laws and policies to make the centers more transparent and accountable. Colorado's Office of Behavioral Health Director Robert Worthwine has been outspoken about the need for those changes. Let's just say, and I'm trying to be diplomatic, that a lot of work needs to be done, he said of MindSpring's in particular. He will not be there to help make reforms because his department announced earlier this month that he will resign in February. Senator won't back plan. Manchin is pulling support from Biden's social policy bill, imperiling its passage, by Emily Cochran and Katie Edmondson of the New York Times. Senator Joe Manchin said Sunday that he could not support President Joe Biden's signature $2.2 trillion social safety net climate and tax bill, dooming his party's drive to pass its marquee domestic policy legislation as written. The comments from Manchin, Democrat West Virginia, a longtime centrist holdout, dealt the latest and perhaps a fatal blow to the centerpiece of Biden's domestic agenda, barely a day after senators left Washington for the year after Democrats conceded they could not yet push through any of their top legislative priorities. From the social policy bill to a voting rights overhaul, I cannot vote to continuing with this piece of legislation, Manchin said on Fox News Sunday, citing concerns about adding to the nation's debt, rising inflation, and the spread of the latest coronavirus variant. I've tried everything humanly possible. I can't get there. This is a no. In a statement released shortly afterward, he was scathing toward his own party, declaring that my Democratic colleagues in Washington are determined to dramatically reshape our society in a way that leaves our country even more vulnerable to the threats we face. I cannot take that risk with a staggering debt of more than $29 trillion and with inflation hurting Americans with no end in sight, he said. It amounted to Manchin's most definitive rejection of the sprawling measure which party leaders muscled through the House in November after maintaining a drumbeat of concern about its cost and ambitious scope. With Republicans united in imposing the legislation, Democrats needed the votes of all 50 senators who caucused with their party for the measure to pass in an evenly divided Senate, effectively handing each of them veto power. Manchin's condemnation of the measure also underscores how White House officials may have overestimated their ability to persuade him to embrace a more generous package, and how his often murky statements may have fed their optimism despite his serious misgivings about the cost. Manchin's comments on Sunday provoked an unusually blistering broadside from Jen Psaki, the White House press secretary, who accused Manchin in a lengthy statement of reneging on his promises. As recently as Tuesday, Psaki said, Manchin had pledged to work with administration officials to finalize a compromise agreement and had even shared his own outline for legislation that mirrored the size of Biden's initial $1.85 trillion framework. If his comments on Fox and written statement indicate an end to that effort, she said, they represent a sudden and inexplicable reversal in his position and a breach of his commitments to the president and the senator's colleagues in the House and Senate. Manchin outlined the conditions for his vote in a July 28th memo signed with Senator Chuck Schumer of New York, the majority leader, which became public in late September, saying that it must be fully paid for and that any revenue more than $1.5 trillion must go toward lowering the federal budget deficit. That memo included limits on who could benefit from new programs and a ban on repealing fossil fuel tax credits, and a warning that his vote would not be guaranteed if his conditions were exceeded. However, Manchin has largely focused his attention on what he does not want in the package and has been vague about what programs and policies he might support. In recent weeks, he has continued to insist that the bill shrink and that it refrain from short-term budget gimmicks, which would most likely require lawmakers to fund fewer programs over the long term. It remained unclear on Sunday whether an overhaul of the legislation could both salvage Manchin's support and retain enough liberal votes in both chambers. The impasse jeopardizes Biden's reputation as a dealmaker. He had campaigned on his ability to capitalize on nearly four decades of Senate experience to helm negotiations and unite his party's narrow majorities in both chambers. Biden had poured weeks of work into talks with Manchin, inviting the senator for breakfast at his Delaware home in October and insisting that the West Virginia could ultimately be swayed. At stake is what Biden has hailed as transformative, New Deal-style legislation that would touch virtually every American life from birth to death, from subsidies for child care to price controls for prescription drugs to funding for the construction and maintenance of public housing. Failure to pass the measure also would deal a setback to vulnerable Democratic lawmakers bracing for what is expected to be a challenging midterm campaign in the coming months. They had hoped that passage of the bill would help their political standing, given that Republicans are widely expected to reclaim control of the House. After months of negotiations, one Democratic U.S. senator has now summarily walked away from productive negotiations, said Representative Abigail Spanberger, Democrat Virginia, who represents a swing district. That is unacceptable, and we cannot act like this moment is the end. Children, families, and the future of our planet are counting on us. The legislation, originally sketched out as a $3.5 trillion budget blueprint, had already been curtailed substantially to satisfy Manchin and a few other centrists through months of laborious negotiations. As it is, an expanded $300 monthly payment to most families with children, which Manchin voted for as part of the $1.9 trillion pandemic aid package in March, will lapse at the end of the year without an extension included in the package. Long-sought promises to patch gaps in the American healthcare system, from expanding coverage to an estimated 3.4 million Americans, to improving Medicare benefits and regulating drug prices, will go unfilled. Publicly and privately, administration officials have declined to characterize Manchin's positions or demands in the negotiations or say what assurances he had offered to support the legislation as it was being created. That changed Sunday when Psaki and Manchin had pledged to back the framework Biden announced this fall and had submitted his own offer for a bill in person at the White House last week, a meeting the officials had not previously divulged. But Manchin's blunt condemnation of the measure on Sunday upended a precarious detente within the party on Capitol Hill. House moderates fumed that they had voted for a measure that would not become law, and liberals accused Manchin of single-handedly torpedoing their ability to deliver on the campaign promises that they argue had delivered them control of both Congress and the White House. Party leaders had initially sought to move the expansive climate and tax plan known as the Build Back Better Act in tandem with a $1 trillion infrastructure bill Manchin and a bipartisan group of senators helped negotiate earlier this year. But to satisfy moderates anxious for a legislative victory while talks on the broader plan continued, the infrastructure plan was decoupled and became law. Furious liberal lawmakers who had long warned that there was no guarantee conservative Democrats would support the more ambitious package if the two bills were not paired demanded answers from party leaders who had promised both bills would ultimately become law. Republicans were gleeful at Manchin's stance and the intraparty division having sought to justify his long-standing concerns about the legislation's cost and funding. President Biden's mega spending bill is dead, and Joe Manchin put the nail in the coffin, crowed Senator Ben Sasse, Republican Nebraska, with a divided country, a 50-50 Senate, and a blowout inflation. The American people don't want to upend this country with nakedly partisan legislation. In his statement, Manchin also expressed concern that Biden's marquee bill would move the nation's economy away from fossil fuels too rapidly. Climate experts said they believe there is little room left to compromise on the measure's major climate change provisions. Manchin already has rejected the part of the bill that would have been the single most effective tool to reduce greenhouse gases, a clean electricity program that would have rewarded power plants that switched from burning fossil fuels to solar, wind, and other clean sources, and punished those that did not. Omicron may sideline two key drugs by Matthew Perrone of the AP. As strained U.S. hospitals brace for a new surge of COVID-19 cases caused by the fast-spreading Omicron variant, doctors are warning of yet another challenge. The two standard drugs they've used to fight infections are unlikely to work against the new strain. For more than a year, antibody drugs from Regeneron and Eli Lilly have been the go-to treatments for early COVID-19, thanks to their ability to head off severe disease and keep patients out of the hospital. But both drug makers recently warned that the laboratory testing suggests that therapies will be much less potent against Omicron, which contains dozens of mutations that make it harder for antibodies to attack the virus. And while the companies say they can quickly develop new Omicron-targeting antibodies, those aren't expected to launch for at least several months. A third antibody from British drug maker GlaxoSmithKline appears to be the best position to fight Omicron, but Glaxo's drug is not widely available in the U.S., accounting for a small portion of the millions of doses purchased and distributed by the federal government. The U.S. health officials are now rationing scarce drug supplies to states. "I think there's going to be a shortage," said Dr. Jonathan Lee, director of the Harvard Brigham Virology Specialty Laboratory. "We're down to one FDA-authorized monoclonal antibody with Omicron because of the reduced effectiveness of Regeneron and Lilly's drugs." The Delta variant still accounts for more than 95% of estimated U.S. cases, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. However, agency leaders say Omicron is spreading faster than any past variant and will become the dominant strain nationwide within weeks. President Joe Biden plans to speak Tuesday on the status of the fight against COVID-19 and discuss government help for communities in need of assistance, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki tweeted. "Delivered by injection or infusion, antibodies are laboratory-made versions of human proteins that help the immune system fight off viruses and other infections. Glaxo's drug, developed with Vir Biotechnology, was specifically formulated to bind to a part of the virus that is less likely to mutate, according to the companies. Early studies by laboratory simulated Omicron by the drug makers and outside researchers show promising results. Supply of the drug is extremely limited, and additional doses of the product will not be available until the week of January 3rd, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services said in a statement posted online. After pausing distribution last month to conserve supply, HHS is now shipping 55,000 doses of the drug called Sotrovimab to state health departments, with the doses arriving as early as Tuesday. An additional 300,000 are expected in January. The agency said it is distributing the drug to states based on their levels of infections and hospitalizations. HHS recommends states conserve the drug for the highest risk patients who are most likely to have Omicron infections, either based on laboratory testing that can identify the variant or elevated levels of Omicron spread in local communities identified as 20% and higher. High-risk patients include seniors and those with serious health problems such as obesity, heart disease, diabetes, and immune system disorders. Prior to the pause in shipments, Glaxo's drug accounted for about 10% of the 1.8 million antibody doses distributed to state health officials between mid-September and late November, according to federal figures. London-based Glaxo says it is on track to produce 2 million doses by May under contracts with the U.S., Canada, the U.K., Japan, and several other countries. The company is working to add more manufacturing capacity next year. The loss of two leading antibody therapies puts even more focus on a pair of highly anticipated antiviral pills that U.S. regulators are expected to soon authorize. The drugs from Pfizer and Merck would be the first treatments Americans can take at home to head off severe disease. Pfizer's drug in particular has shown a powerful effect, curbing hospitalizations and deaths by nearly 90% in high-risk patients. If it's rolled out effectively, this has a real big potential to make up for antibody treatments, said Andrew Pakaz, a virologist at Johns Hopkins University. That's an immediate place where these antivirals could minimize the impact of Omicron. Becker plans stronger action. Biden's EPA pick in the West aims to restore protections dropped under Trump, by Conrad Swanson. Stronger regulations for the oil and gas industry, clean air and water, and funding shortages should be top priorities for Casey Becker as she takes over as administrator for the Environmental Protection Agency's Region 8, environmental advocates and tribal representatives say. Not only should Becker, who is the former Speaker of the Colorado House, help the federal agency rebuild protections slashed under former President Donald Trump, the advocates say, but she should also push to broaden them further. In her new position, Becker said she will oversee about 500 employees, help craft and enforce national policies meant to protect the environment and public health. She'll also dole out millions in federal funding to help clean contaminated areas, improve infrastructure, and monitor polluting industries. Becker's Region 8 covers Colorado, Montana, North Dakota, South Dakota, Utah, and Wyoming. Three of those states, Colorado, North Dakota, and Utah, have some of the fastest-growing populations in the country, census data shows. And the region covers some of the country's most treasured lands, like Arches, Badlands, Glacier, Grand Teton, Rocky Mountain, and Yellowstone National Parks. Yes, there are these amazingly beautiful places, said Stephanie Kodish, senior director and counsel for the National Parks Conservation Association. But there are also some very substantial challenges, Kodish added. Becker said she's ready to face those challenges, adding that climate change, environmental justice, and degrading infrastructure also sit high on her priority list. Federal officials don't want to induce whiplash, but will be taking stronger action than the last administration. Progress had not been made in the last 4 years, Becker told the Denver Post. Really, I'm focused. And EPA Administrator Michael Reagan is focused on making real on-the-ground changes that improve air quality, water quality, improve everybody's quality of life. Dan Grossman of the Environmental Defense Fund said Becker's well-suited for the role, especially as President Joe Biden's administration shifts away from the lax rules and regulations set by Trump's EPA. I'm very grateful we're under new management, Grossman, who directs the National Environmental Nonprofit's Rocky Mountain Office, said. We're already seeing a lot of progress. Biden appointed Becker, a Democrat, to the role last month. Term limited, she left the legislature last year, and her time in the State House was marked by pushing aggressive climate action policies and a 2019 law overhauling regulation of the state's oil and gas industry. Democrats and environmentalists lauded the move, though industry leaders accused the lawmakers behind the legislation of operating in the middle of the night and warned that it could cripple the state's economy. Regulating the oil and gas industry, Colorado, North Dakota, and Wyoming still serve as home to booming oil and gas developments polluting the air, Kotich said. The industry, alongside gas-operated vehicles, is one of the main sources of ozone pollution. Those pollution levels spiked so high along the Front Range this year that the EPA is likely to downgrade Colorado's air quality violator status from serious to severe. Becker must not only work to tighten regulations on the industry, but she also must strengthen enforcement to force violators to lower their emissions, Kotich said. Colorado Oil and Gas President and CEO Dan Haley has repeatedly urged regulators to pump the brakes on certain regulations, like continuous emission monitoring requirements, and has warned of increased fuel costs and damage to an industry that produces millions of dollars for Colorado's economy. Conversations about complicated technologies and emission reductions need to be steeped in facts, not scare tactics or suppositions, Haley said in a 2019 news release responding to new regulations from the state's Air Quality Control Commission. Haley and other industry officials did not respond to messages seeking comment for this article. Under the Biden administration, tighter industry regulations are already in the works. A plan publicized last month by the EPA would require oil and gas companies to more aggressively detect and cut methane emissions. The goal is to cut those emissions by 74% from 2005 levels by 2035. Once the plan is finalized, individual states will likely be left to draft plans applying the new rules to companies, Grossman said. And Becker will be in a position to act as validator to ensure plans in Region 8 states meet federal requirements. New regulations must also consider that communities of color and those with lower-income residents must often disproportionately carry the burden of pollution, Becker said. There's a lot going on in the clean air space, she added. And protecting waterways from pollution. Similarly, there's a lot going on in the clean water space, said Jen Peltz, Wild Rivers Program Director with the environmental nonprofit Wild Earth Guardians. And front of mind for many environmentalists is which waterways should be protected. Trump's EPA stripped protections from ephemeral and intermittent streams, which only flow during storms or certain times of the year, Peltz said. About 68% of Colorado's waterways fit into that category. If all of that water in Colorado isn't protected and clean, then those pollutants or developments cause problems further downstream too, Peltz said. Representatives from the Colorado Farm Bureau praised the move in late 2019. The old regulations enacted under President Barack Obama obscured land use rights for the state's farmers, Colorado Farm Bureau President Don Shawcroft said at the time. Becker, however, said the Trump administration went way too far, and the Biden administration is now working to restore many of those lost protections. But Peltz said that's not enough. Don't just restore the protections that existed before, Peltz said. Think about the challenges we face going forward and put forward the broadest protections possible. As populations continue to grow and climate change drives many of the country's rivers and streams, clean water will be all the more important in the years to come, Peltz said. Looking to the future, Colorado Farm Bureau Executive Vice President Chad Vorthman said in a statement that he hopes Becker and the rest of the EPA will protect the agriculture industry from unnecessary regulations and ensure farmers have a say in new policies. Casey Becker is a tough negotiator, but knows how to bring stakeholders together to discuss concerns, Vorthman said. She is knowledgeable about important issues like natural resources and water, and we look forward to working with her in her new role. Native American tribes and funding. While water supply shrivels across the West, so too is the money allocated to the 28 Native American tribes in Region 8, said Richard Jansen, Jr., head of the Natural Resources Department for the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes in the northwestern Montana. It gets frustrating that year after year, funding for the tribes keeps getting cut, Jansen said. Each tribe sets its own water and air quality standards, among other protections, and uses money from the EPA to pay inspectors and enforce those regulations, Jansen said. And during the Trump administration, funding for the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes shrank by as much as 25%, he said. Becker said she'll lobby for more money for the tribes, and already some should be on the way from the $1.2 trillion bipartisan infrastructure bill Congress passed in November. Millions more from the bill will be set aside for the six states in Becker's region, she said. And her responsibility will be to allocate money to local governments looking to replace lead service lines, replacing diesel school buses with electric ones, soil remediation programs, and more. All told, Becker said her appointment represents a huge opportunity for her to put her past experience to use, protecting not only the environment, but also public health. And the historic spending package paired with the Biden administration's environmental goals are going to have a really measurable impact on people's everyday lives. Now to sports. Bungled. Broncos playoff hopes take hit with Bridgewater lost to injury, and Locke's red zone fumble costly as Denver's offense fizzles by Ryan O'Halloran. Minus their starting quarterback and anything resembling an effective passing game, the Broncos' tailback tandem of Melvin Gordon and Javonte Williams was just starting to churn out rushing yards early in the fourth quarter Sunday against Cincinnati. Punch it in for the go-ahead touchdown, close out the Bengals, and stay in the AFC wildcard hunt. But one play ruined everything. The game, the season, likely the future of Coach Vic Fangio. Playing in relief of Teddy Bridgewater, who was at a local hospital because of a head injury, Drew Locke made the kind of play and the kind of mistake that brought back memories of his play last year. From the Bengals' 9-yard line, Locke faked a handoff and then kept the football and was stripped by defensive end Khalid Kareem, the deciding play in the Broncos' 15-10 loss that sent them tumbling to 12th in the conference with three games remaining. The Bengals scored one offensive touchdown and had one play longer than 22 yards, but overtook Baltimore for the AFC North lead because they didn't make the back-breaking Broncos-type error. "We didn't play well enough, that's the message," outside linebacker Bradley Chubb said. The message sent by the Broncos was clear. They aren't good enough to break the franchise's 5-year playoff drought. One touchdown and no takeaways in a must-win game? Suboptimal. The loss crippled the Broncos' hopes, period. They started Sunday in a demolition derby of 7-6 teams, just on the fringe of the wild card race. They walked back to the locker room knowing the deck stacked against them is significant. The Broncos need to sweep their division rivals at the Raiders, at the Chargers, and home against Kansas City, and also get teams such as Cleveland, Indianapolis, Buffalo, and even the Bengals to fold down the stretch. One problem? The Broncos have stunk against their division since the start of 2018, 5-10 under Fangio. "We're not out of contention, so we're going to have another good week of preparation and get ready for the next game," Fangio said. Las Vegas's game Saturday at Cleveland was delayed until Monday because of the Browns' COVID-19 issues, so the Broncos will have the rest advantage when they visit the desert next Sunday, and they may have a new starting quarterback. The Broncos' offensive struggles took an emotional backseat in the third quarter when Bridgewater slammed the side of his head into the turf after a scramble. A team of trainers and physicians removed the face mask from his helmet, stabilized his neck and spine, fastened him to a backboard, and boarded him on an ambulance. Fangio said the test results checked out positively, but Bridgewater would be hospitalized overnight for observation. Locke entered for his third relief appearance, and it's always something, right? Week 4 against Baltimore, sacked 3 times and intercepted once. Week 12 against the Chargers, a careless second quarter interception. And Sunday against the Bengals, the lost fumble. Locke's game started well enough. After Bridgewater was injured, the Broncos moved into Cincinnati territory, and Locke capped the drive with a 25-yard touchdown pass to receiver Tim Patrick, his first score since Week 9 at Dallas. The lead lasted 45 seconds. Broncos safety Kareem Jackson appeared to bite on quarterback Joe Burrow's play-action fake and was out of position when receiver Tyler Boyd ran a right-to-left route behind Jackson. Boyd caught Burrow's pass at the Broncos' 33 and turned safety Justin Simmons around at the 27 to score untouched. It was the longest touchdown pass allowed by the Broncos this year. "Poor execution all around, and when it comes to me, I have to get him down and give my defense another play," Simmons said. The Broncos' offense answered with an efficient drive, including a 24-yard catch by tight end Albert Okwuegbunam, a 13-yard drawn pass interference penalty by receiver Cortland Sutton, and a 13-yard run by Gordon to set up first down from the Bengals 10. On second down from the 9, Locke identified a packed tackle box, so he opted not to hand off to Williams, who was running right. Kareem shuffled inside a few steps but remained in position when Locke tried to beat him inside. Kareem simply stole the ball from Locke. Good play by Kareem or bad ball security by Locke? Probably both, Fangio said. Locke decided to keep it, and he didn't get it tucked away, and the guy took it away. Said Locke, I should have handed that thing off to Javonte, looking back. But also, if I made the defensive end miss and run that thing into the end zone, who knows what is being said right now. Locke knows exactly what would have been said. He had atoned himself for two poor outings this year to keep the Broncos in the playoff hunt, earning him appropriate praise. Instead, the Broncos had their first red zone turnover since week 5 at Pittsburgh, and the Broncos' defense couldn't answer with a takeaway, which was their only blemish besides Boyd's touchdown. The glaring thing for me was no takeaways, and the formula for winning is playing complementary football and finding ways to set your offense up on a short field, Simmons said. We did a lot of things well, but that's one we didn't do well at all. The task facing the Broncos, which lost at home this year for the fourth time as the favorite, is to do everything well over the final three games. I know the percentages have dropped, maybe even drastically, but by no means does it mean the last three games. We're saying, let's finish out these games and whatever, Simmons said. If other teams lose and we win, we still have a shot. Time to fire Vic, start restoring lost credibility by Mark Kisla. The only thing the Broncos are really good at is ripping the hearts out of the people who love them most. A 15-10 loss to Cincinnati on Sunday reminded us of everything that's wrong with a football franchise whose holes in the roster are exceeded only by the lack of accountability for this hot mess. When Bengals defensive end Khalid Kareem ripped the football from quarterback Drew Locke in the fourth quarter, it felt like he reached inside the chest of every Broncos fan and stole the last vestiges of hope. When is enough finally enough? For 3 years, Coach Vic Fangio has given us an excruciatingly slow death by inches. Put the team up for sale? Why wait until January? The bickering between Beth and Brittany Bolin has been an embarrassment to their late father's legacy and a disservice to all the playing customers who have paid their hard-earned money to support the Broncos. With silver spoons, the Bolin kids threw dirt on the civic treasury they weren't worthy to oversee. If general manager George Patton has hit the guts to do right by Broncos country, he will fire everybody in charge of this disaster on the field, from Fangio to quarterback Teddy Bridgewater. Let's send prayers to Bridgewater as he recovers from a frightening head injury, but is there any compelling reason for him to be back in the Denver huddle ever again? Enough of the heartache. Get a broom and sweep up the shards of the poor souls, still foolish enough to believe Fangio when he analyzes the playoff picture and claims, we're not out. Put a lid on it, Uncle Vic. The Broncos might be mathematically alive, but they're emotionally wasted. We want to win just as bad as everyone wants us to win. We want to win more than fans want us to win, said safety Justin Simmons after the Denver defense held Cincy quarterback Joe Burrow to 157 yards passing and limited running back Joe Mixon to 57 yards rushing. It just stinks when you play close games like this. You have to find a way to make it happen. Good teams find a way to make the playoffs. Denver keeps inventing new ways to lose, with Locke keeping the football on an option play and handing it to Kareem on a platter with the Broncos 9 yards from the end zone and a fourth quarter lead, pure slapstick that was so funny it could make you cry. When you're losing a game, it's hard not to feel as a quarterback that you need to go and do it yourself, Locke said. He has learned to be self-critical, but still can't get out of his own way, because that's not the way Locke is wired. It is in my DNA, he said, to go out there and do a little bit more than I'm asked of, maybe. After this defeat, you could go to that internet thingy and find a gloomy analytical forecast for the team's playoff chances, now pegged at less than 10%. Want a Christmas miracle? Pray for snow for Colorado ski resorts. What are the odds the Broncos will sweep the Raiders, Chargers, and Chiefs and get the help needed to earn a postseason invitation? Frosty the Snowman would have better luck living a long and prosperous life in Death Valley. After 9,028 fans ate their tickets instead of showing up to Empower Field at Mile High on a sunny 61-degree Sunday in December for what was billed as the most important game played by the Broncos since Super Bowl 50, you, I, and Team President Joe Ellis know it would make zero economic sense to try to reheat this garbage and sell it again next year. I get paid to watch this hot mess, but do feel your pain. We're all tired of the woulda, coulda, shoulda excuses and the endless three and outs. We're sick of receiver Jerry Jeudy being a spectator in uniform, as well as Locke stumbling over his own bloated ego. The Denver offense is a delusional figment of Pat Shurmur's imagination, and his hiring was a fireable offense, a far bigger mistake by Fangio than any misuse of timeouts or blind squirrel challenges of questionable calls by the refs. It's not only time to turn the page. This sad book needs to be closed and tossed in the fire. Patton shouldn't wait until tomorrow or the day after Christmas. Get on with the serious, hard business of building a better future and get started today. The NFL now allows teams that dismiss their head coach or issue notification that he won't be returning for another year to begin the interview process for replacements during the final 2 weeks of the season. That's one of the many reasons why it made sense for Jacksonville to part ways with Urban Meyer and get on with the process of finding a coach who would relish the opportunity to develop young quarterback Trevor Lawrence. By the same token, might it make sense for Patton to dismiss Fangio and elevate Mike Munchak to interim head coach? Be upfront with the coaching vacancy in Denver. Change is coming, so why wait? Enough is enough. Bury the heartbreak. Let's get on with shaping a brighter future for the Broncos. And from CU Women's Basketball, unbeaten Buffs aim to finish strong by Brian Howell of thebuffzone.com. Following a 78-55 win against SMU on Friday night, someone pointed out to Colorado Women's Basketball assistant coach Toriano Towns that the Buffs went 9-for-9 from the free throw line. He said something like, "Well, we should have been 9-for-9 on layups," CU head coach J.R. Payne said. CU isn't taking wins for granted, especially the blowout wins, but this is a team with a different mindset. "I want greatness in everything we're doing," Payne said, "and I think that speaks volumes to where we are and how far we've come. I know the players also want that. We're all excited that we won by 20, but we also are all going to stew about some of the things we didn't do effectively, so I think that's a good sign for a good team." On Monday, the Buffs, who are 10-0, will continue their quest to improve as they host San Francisco in the final non-conference game of the season. CU is no stranger to hot starts. In fact, this is just the seventh 10-0 start in program history, but three have come during Payne's six seasons. The non-conference schedule has been set up for hot starts in recent years, but that hasn't always translated to long-term success. The Buffs started 10-0 in 2016-17, but went 7-16 the rest of the season. In 2019-20, they started 12-0, but went 4-14 the rest of the way. With the Pac-12 gauntlet coming up soon, the Buffs travel to Oregon State on December 31st to get conference play started. CU wants to make sure Monday's game is a good final tune-up, especially with 11 days off for a holiday break following the game. Right now, it's just trying to do the things that we're good at and just trying to work on those and be perfect in those aspects, says senior Maya Hollingshead, who leads the Buffs in scoring and rebounding. When Pac-12 play comes around, we just have to be perfect every night. There can't be those mishaps because a team can get hot and they can go up by 20 and we'll look up and we're down by 20. So we're just trying to fix those things now so when that time comes, we can adjust and play out of that just adapt towards that. Hollingshead said it's important to finish strong in the non-conference slate and recharge during the break because once they return, I think that will change our mindset and our focus. So far this season, the Buffs have been focused and dialed in nearly every game. The challenge on Monday will be to do that again and put aside the fact that after the game, the players get to go home for the holidays. It's important just being able to lock in on that game, junior center Kay Miller said, with being able to go home still. I know people are excited to go home and see their families, but I think the test is to see how focused and locked in we can be before our vacation break. Goja takes Super G, Schifrin Fifth. From Val d'Isère, France, Sofia Goja has been unbeaten in downhill for an entire year. Now the Olympic champion from Italy is starting to dominate in Super G, too. Goja won the last Women's World Cup Super G of the calendar year Sunday, a day after she triumphed in her seventh straight downhill. Sunday's result made her the only skier with multiple Super G wins this season. Goja mastered the tricky middle section of the OK course to beat Ragnar Mowinckel of Norway by 33/100ths of a second. Italian teammates Elena Cortona and Federica Bergoni were third and fourth, respectively, followed by Michaela Schifrin, who finished 75/100ths off the lead in fifth. Goja increased her lead over Schifrin in the overall standings to 65 points. The American initially planned to sit out the race and only decided last Wednesday to compete. Next up are eight technical races where Schifrin usually scores more points than Goja. Thank you for joining us for the Denver Post. My name is Dee Hyslop.